Pope Francis is finally discharged from the hospital in Rome after making his first public appearance in over 5 weeks. The Papal Posse, Father Gerald Murray, Robert Royal, are here with analysis. And director and executive producer of The Chosen, Dallas Jenkins, is here to talk about season 5 of the smash hit. And ethicist Father Tad Pacholczyk takes a look at the Trump administration's move to freeze funding for Planned Parenthood. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this evening. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo, or I'm on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show. Pope Francis is back home at the Vatican following more than a month of hospitalization, and the Rupnik scandal reemerges, while Cardinal Robert McElroy speaks out against President Trump's immigration policy. Here with analysis of all of this and more is the Papal Posse. Editor-in-chief of thecatholicthing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. I want to start with the biggest news of the week, Pope Francis's first public appearance in over a month, followed by his discharge from the Gemelli Clinic to continue his recovery at the Casa Santa Marta in the Vatican. Here's Pope Francis from Sunday, March 23rd.
Grazie a tutti. E vedo questa signora con i fiori gialli. È brava.
Father, your thoughts on the Pope's appearance on Sunday, did it send the reassuring message that the Vatican had hoped? And then I want to talk about that, the end of the appearance there.
No, it was concerning to see how difficult it was for the Holy Father to speak. He could just say a couple of sentences. At the end, when he gave the blessing, it was concerning to see he really couldn't raise his right hand and make the full sign of the cross. He looked weak. When he finished the whole thing, you could see kind of a distress in his face. I think he has great difficulty breathing. And I think, you know, being in the bed and in a chair for so long has caused, you know, his muscle tone to go way down. So he's got a long recuperation.
They obviously removed the oxygen, Father. And during that 2-minute appearance at the window, you know, when they pulled the wheelchair back, you could see him gasping for air. And then he closed his eyes. It was obviously an enormous struggle for him to come out even for a few minutes.
Yes. And, you know, the oxygen was back on when he was in the car to take him back to the Vatican. So, no, I see him as really needing basically total rest and recuperation for the next couple of months to reestablish his strength and, you know, to be able to have control, you know, over his body, to be able to move more freely and to be able to speak more freely. It's going to take time and a lot of physiotherapy and the like.
Yeah. Bob, there was that moment, we showed it, where he recognized this lady who's in the front row there in front of the Gemelli Clinic. Carmela Mancuso is her name, who is holding a bouquet of flowers. He greeted, you know, her in front of the crowd. She has a history of bringing flowers to the Pope at various audiences. But I noticed on the Vatican camera, they cut away to her, and it seemed as if whoever was pushing the Pope, you know, whispered to him to make sure to notice her and give the sign of the cross. Did this feel a bit staged to you?
Well, maybe it is. But in another way, too, it's a moment when I think every Catholic has to feel some sense of solidarity with the Pope. I mean, he's a real tough guy. We've learned this week that he told the doctors when they were perhaps ready to give up on him, let's not give up. So, I mean, you see that, and a lot of people were praying for him. And look, even if it was somewhat staged, for me, it was a moment at which, in spite of everything that we'd heard about over the past few weeks, it's a moment of respite. And let's just say it was something beautiful. that a Catholic appreciating a pope was honored in that way.
The director of Santa Marta House, where the pope lives, a Monsignor Battista Rica, who some might remember famously for the "Who am I to judge?" comment, which came from his appointment. He announced this week that Pope Francis will remain isolated in his bedroom for at least 2 months as he continues to recuperate. What does that isolation mean in this case? I mean, one wonders if he, you know, is he going to have visitors as he did at Gemelli? What does this look like?
Well, I think according to what I've read, that his top aides, Cardinal Parolin and Archbishop Peña Parra, will be the go-betweens between the pope and his secretary and his medical staff and the rest of the Curie and the world. So this is going to be an unusual period of any pontificate, but certainly of this. If there was any pope who was out in front of the media and giving interviews and meeting all kinds of people, mm-hmm. it was Pope Francis. Now we're going to rely on these intermediaries. I think it's going to be difficult for the pope to be isolated because, you know, he loves the energy that he gets from being out among the people. But let's see what happens because, you know, there are a lot of things going on in the next 3 months in the life of the church. And let's see what the level of energy and activity the pope is going to engage in through his intermediaries.
Bob, there was an op-ed written from the hospital. Appointments went forward. But to give people a bit of context, here in the United States, the Apostolic Nuncio was presiding at the Mass of Consecration for the new Archbishop of Detroit this week, and he announced that the pope was unable to sign the bull of appointment due to his illness. The nuncio issued one of his own while assuring the world that it was all legal. Let me start with Father on this one. Is it legal, Father? And then I'll go to Bob.
Yes, it is. Nuncios have the power to make presentation of new archbishops based on a decree that was issued by the Vatican a number of years ago. So that canonically, really, you're the bishop of the diocese once you get named by the pope, and we certainly know he was named. The presentation of the bull and the massive installation is really a formality in the long run.
Bob, your thoughts on this, though, because it is indicative that the pope really couldn't even bring himself to sign a bull. And it's no surprise that the pope's planned meeting with King Charles will be postponed. Your thought about this isolation we could be looking at over the next 2 months at least?
Yeah, I think medically it's going to be very dicey because he cannot risk having another infection. And, you know, he was treated with very, very serious drugs. I asked a doctor of my acquaintance, and she told me that just the antibiotics alone can have, you know, terrible effects on your kidneys and mm-hmm. on your bone marrow and other things. So he's got to be very careful that that doesn't happen. And, of course, there are other possible, knock-on consequences down the line. But look, this raises a very serious question because, you know, some people have been joking that this is sort of the auto pen that people joke about with Joe Biden, but transferred mm-hmm. into the Vatican. Some people say the auto plume, you know, that might be here. And we do have to be assured that what we're going to be hearing coming out of the Vatican is, in fact, coming from the pope himself, if that's the way it's being presented. So there are two sides of this. I think there's the medical side, and then there's the administrative side. And you always hear from people, I hear this from the Swiss guards, I hear this from other people who are involved in the Vatican, that you can try to limit what the pope is going to do and who he's going to see. But at the end of the day, he's the pope, and he's going to want to do what he can do, and it's very hard to say no to him. So there's going to be a bit of drama over the next few months.
Yeah, and let's get into some of this drama. I mean, one of his physicians, Dr. Luis Carbone, his nurse, Massimiliano Strappetti, his pre-secretary, Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, and Pietro Parolin, the Secretary of State, they're all part of that inner circle. Father, what do you expect to see regarding church business that is being done in the weeks and months ahead? I mean, how much assurance do we have that this is actually coming from the pope?
Well, we have to assume that it is coming from the pope because the Vatican machinery is operating on that basis. Now, the question is, who's telling all the people operating that machinery that the pope wants this or that? Certainly with the nomination of bishops, that's continued on right through the period of the papal hospitalization. In fact, yesterday we got the nomination of the new Bishop of Cordoba, Spain. And that was a big deal because he's only been retired about 6 weeks, he sent in his letter. So that was acted on quickly. Now, we have a number of archbishops in the United States who are over the retirement age of 75. So it's going to be interesting whether, the cardinal who is in prefect of the dicastery for bishops is going, Cardinal Prevost, will he be conducting the usual weekly meetings or frequent meetings that he had with the Pope for nominations? Or will all of that go through Cardinal Parolin? I'm going to suspect that. But, you know, we have the Synod on Synodality progress going on. There are all kinds of scheduled meetings happening. We have the Holy Year of Hope. So this is a big question mark. And, you know, my goal, or my hope, rather, would be that we would be kept informed on the state of progress of the Pope's activities, and that we would be able to see him. Hopefully he can do his weekly Angelus on Sundays, either by recording or personally if he can't leave his room. So I think it's up to the Vatican to assure people that, yes, the Pope is in charge, he knows what he's doing, and he's doing it consciously with the aid of people such as Cardinal Parolin.
But Bob, despite the vague updates provided by the Vatican during Pope Francis's hospitalization, we now know just how precarious his condition was. The Pope's physician, Dr. Sergio Alfieri, admitted that he and his team considered stopping treatment to Pope Francis when he came very close to death due to the condition he found himself in around February the 28th. Here's the quote. "We had to choose whether to stop and let him go or to force and try with all possible drugs and therapies, running the very high risk of damaging other organs." Now, Bob, I don't think this surprises anyone, but your thoughts on the stark reality of what was actually happening there in the hospital and what the Vatican was reporting over the 38-day stay.
Yeah, I thought that this was very revelatory. We had no sense that the doctors themselves were kind of thinking that, maybe we shouldn't just let him continue to suffer needlessly, and even as they were letting us know that he had those two very serious episodes. It was striking to me that this doctor, who seems to be a sober fellow, I like the way he handled the interviews with a couple of the Italian journals. He describes what happened as miracle. He said that, you know, when you hear a doctor say that it's a miracle that my patient recovered, when he's a medical man, a scientist, it tells you actually how very serious they thought it was. We had no idea. We knew that it was serious. We had no idea that it was that degree of seriousness that they were having to decide life and death, literally, at the time. But two miracles, and there were an awful lot of people praying for the Pope. And let's hope that in the weeks and months to come, we get the best possible outcome for the Holy Father that we can possibly get at this point.
Father, the attending physician there mentioned the risk of organ damage and failure because of the therapies that the Pope was subjected to. One wonders what effect this will have on the Pope's system, and how will we know?
Well, I mean, that's what the speculation's going to be based on, what we've learned so far. And then people compare that with the video that we saw of the Pope coming out on the balcony. You know, he was in great distress with having spoken briefly. And again, he doesn't seem to have much strength. What is that a result of? We have, I hope that there will be some medical indications over time, because this isn't curiosity. You know, people want to know other people's business. No, the Pope is the leader of the Catholic Church. We pray for his health and recovery. But the public needs to be reassured that he is, in fact, able to carry out these tasks. And, that's, I think, a responsible public relations strategy from the Holy See would be more information, not less.
Yeah. No, this is going to be a very interesting and potentially perilous moment for the credibility of the Vatican, depending on how the Pope's health progresses, if he recovers, if he has a setback, and what information is shared with the public, because all of that will point to the credibility of anything we hear coming out of the Vatican. But, gents, from the scandal that won't go away department, the Marco Rupnik affair, that disgraced Jesuit, continues to develop. The Jesuit order is now offering monetary reparations to the 20 women who have said publicly they were sexually, psychologically, and spiritually abused by Father Rupnik. The superior of the Jesuits issued a statement this week saying Rupnik had stubbornly refused to publicly accept responsibilities for his actions and was then expelled from the order. Father, how does this man remain a priest? And what happened to zero tolerance?
Those are great questions, Raymond. We've been talking about this for, what, a year and a half since it was announced that the Vatican would undertake a formal investigation by waiving the statute of limitations, which had been done in many other cases. So the fact it wasn't done in Rupnik's case was made suspicious because of his friendship with the Pope. But what do we have now? A year and a half later, Cardinal Fernandez said he's having trouble getting judges to sit on the tribunal. You know, Cardinal Fernandez, with all due respect, there's a very simple way. You simply call three canon lawyers and said, the Holy Father's name you judge in this case, report to Rome a week from now to sit in this trial. Apparently, you know, the prosecutors are ready to go. This has been slow walking. And now the Jesuit action confirms what everybody knows. The evidence against this former Jesuit, still a priest, but former Jesuit, the evidence is overwhelming. The credibility of the witnesses has been tested and shown to be true. So, you know, zero tolerance for criminal behavior by priests is a minimum. We also have to have accountability by the hierarchy to say we will enforce the law in a timely manner for very good reasons, so that this man can't parade around the world, claim that his victims are maligning him, and then say, well, by the way, I'm a great artist and let me keep making artworks for churches. His artwork should be stripped from every church they're in because they're an indignant reminder of the evil this man has propagated by the fact that he was allowed to go so long under the condition of having nuns under his spiritual care, and he abused them. I mean, this is a horrible case. It needs to be solved very quickly.
Bob, why do you think this is being slow-walked, A? And I mean, Cardinal Fernandez claims he's finalized a list of judges, but they haven't appointed anybody for the canonical trial. And I guess the question is he being protected, Bob, a la Theodore McCarrick?
Well, there has to be something of that nature, obviously, isn't it? The head of the Jesuits actually said that the Jesuits are feeling uncomfortable with this situation of Rupnik, and that's why that they were offering, giving us too many details, they were offering this compensation to these victims. Look, I think we have to say it goes ultimately back to Pope Francis, because this is a major scandal. It's a global scandal that everyone is absolutely aware of. While he was in the hospital, the Holy Father issued a statement asking that the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors to work more closely with the Roman Curia. And from what we can tell from news reports, they were outraged because they've been trying to do this for years, they said. And they got no response. In fact, they got resistance from many members of the Curia. So there seems to be a kind of a network. We don't know exactly who it belongs to us, but no one seems to want to dig into this the way it obviously needs to be dug into. And it ultimately has to go back to the Holy Father, because he himself had to intervene to allow the statute of limitations to be waived. And it isn't hard, as Father rightly says, it isn't hard to tell people, please move forward with this. This is having a deleterious effect against our credibility as a church that really wants to deal with this problem of abuse. It's easy to fix. It ought to be done. And every day that goes by, it looks worse and worse for the Pope and for the church.
Father, I want your take on this as well, because just this week, and this is what it makes you want to rend your garments and scream to the heavens. Just this week, the Vatican News, again, on their official website, they've got Rupnik's trash art featured there on major holy days. And then you've got the Pope sending out this letter to the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors, as Bob just mentioned, to promise to work more closely with the Curia. Well, where were they? Where have they been? And I mean, it seems they're pretty impotent when it comes to somebody like Rupnik and some of these other notorious cases of malefactors that were close to the Pope.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous to say that the Pontifical Commission Protection of Safe Spices and all that, whatever its official name is, that they need to cooperate with the Curia. Why is the Dicastery of Communications using the artwork of a man who was excommunicated, restored, now thrown out of the Jesuits? We know he wouldn't cooperate with the Jesuits in their investigation. And now he's roaming the world as a priest in good standing, while a year and a half later, they're still waiting to constitute a tribunal. The Dicastery for Communication should hang its head in disgrace, because Rupnik's artwork doesn't have to be on anything they put out. That's a choice they made. They're a communication. Yep. They know what the world thinks of this. I would like them to have the victims of Rupnik come to their offices and them to give a rational explanation why Rupnik's art is worthy of a Vatican website. There is no, it's not. This is a terrible, terrible thing that they're doing.
No, it's a hideous slap in the face to every victim and an insult to the faithful who look in on this. And I agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, the Vatican is the ultimate patron of the world's art and the cultural heritage of the Western tradition. Surely there's a picture of St. Joseph that they can find in the archives better than what Rupnik has offered. Okay, I got to move on to this just before we run out of time. A couple of U.S.-based stories. The Diocese of El Paso, Texas, led by Bishop Mark Seitz, he's chair also of the Migration Committee for the USCCB, he held a march for migrants and refugees, calling the White House's immigration initiatives a war on the poor. And in his first public address in Washington, Cardinal Robert McElroy, the new cardinal there, criticized the Trump administration for tightening the southern U.S. border and freezing financial aid to Catholic NGOs. Bob, your thoughts? Why are the U.S. bishops inserting themselves into what really, in many cases here, are purely political questions?
Yeah, I am particularly disturbed when they start using this language of war. We know what kind of violence is tending to bubble up right now in the society. And I would encourage them to get away from that language. Cardinal McElroy himself has also talked about a war of fear and terror against these immigrants. And you rightly say, I mean, it's very difficult to see what their role ought to be in determining what the immigration policy should be. Look, I'm willing to say this. People who have been here for many years, 10 years or more, whatever it is, we bear a certain moral responsibility that we've let them live here for so long, and we really would be disrupting lives if we pulled them out. But for the more recent people that have arrived here, and certainly for the people who are known criminals, just today, in the county where I live in Northern Virginia, one of the three leaders of the MS-13 was picked up by ICE and is in custody and will probably be deported. He's a Salvadoran who's here illegally. I mean, certainly our bishops could come out and try to nuance this situation. Instead of talking about war, talk about how, of course, we need to get rid of criminals who are harming Americans. Of course, Kristi Noem has a right to say, look, to the recent arrivals, you should go home. We'll respect that decision, and we'll give you the opportunity to apply the way other immigrants have applied. But to just use this blanket language as if they are opposed ideologically to what our president, who is a duly elected authority on these issues, to just do that, I think they've stepped out of their role, and they're being ideological in a way that's only going to come back to haunt them.
Father, I only have a minute, but your thoughts on this, particularly that rhetoric of war, when you're talking about MS-13 and the way that these guys call hits, rape and traffic young girls. I mean, your thoughts.
Yeah. Law enforcement is not waging war. Law enforcement is protecting the community. People who enter the country illegally know that they're in jeopardy from the moment they violate the law and do that. Gang members who come up here to facilitate criminal behavior and to associate with other criminals, they're an even worse problem because they're here to positively harm society, rob, steal, murder, and rape. Seizing these people, and the member of the administration says we're starting with rounding up known criminals, that's not a war on anybody. That's a law enforcement operation. Now, as Bob said, people here illegally are in jeopardy because they also can be deported. They should leave voluntarily and get online. For me, it's stunning. Let's say 100 people showed up at the bishop's headquarters today and said, guess what? We live here now. Open the door, and if not, we'll break it down. We're going to go in. We got cots. We're going to stay here. We got food. And if you try to remove us, you're declaring war on us, and you're acting unjustly. No bishop would say that. So why, if the bishops can evict people who illegally go into their headquarters, why can't the country as a whole say, look, you're here illegally, in particular if you're a criminal, you got to leave. And if you won't leave voluntarily, we're going to compel you to leave by arresting you. I have no problem with that. Now, Bob's point is good. if the government is so lassitudinous and, you know, let people stay for 10, 20 years without anything, we should make an arrangement for them in all fairness because they've established roots in the community. But right. You can't just say any movement to get rid of any illegal alien, particularly criminal ones, is a war. No, that's not true.
Yeah, or that border enforcement is a war on the poor. No, that's a protection of the citizens and the common good, in my eyes. I'm glad we're all in agreement, gentlemen. We will leave it there. For commentary by Robert Royal and Father Gerald Murray, visit thecatholicthing.org. Thank you both. And this week on the Arroyo Grande podcast, President Trump took us on a little tour of his new Oval Office, or newly decorated Oval Office. And I sat down with presidential historian Talmadge Boston. We talked about some of the greatest leaders in U.S. history and how we can apply their hard-earned lessons to our own lives, from Washington's quiet strength to Ronald Reagan's use of rhetoric. Take a look. You talk about the great magnanimity of Lincoln. I call it the mercy of Lincoln. Talk to me about that.
Magnanimity means you are great of spirit. It means you always take the high road. It means you're forgiving. You turn the other cheek. You don't take the bait. And so Lincoln, he's got this team of rivals, cabinet, who start out hostile, and most of them come around. He's got these goofy Union generals, particularly McClellan and then Meade, who don't do what they're supposed to do. He's got this very difficult wife, Mary. He's got the southern states who are seceding, even though he says, I'm going to let you keep slavery. So he has all these different constituencies who are giving him all kinds of friction, all kinds of reasons to get angry and retaliate, and he never does. He takes the high road always. And he also has equanimity. He's always calm. He doesn't explode, under control, despite this war going on that's going to 750,000 people are going to lose their lives. Millions are going to be wounded, amputees, et cetera, et cetera.
But he has a great line. I wrote it down. If you don't win the peace, you don't win the war. He was focused on that. How did that mercy extend to those southern states that were in rebellion?
Well, unfortunately, he was killed very shortly after Appomattox. But in terms of his vision for how he wanted the country to be unified, he knew for the southern states who've been killing each other, killing us and vice versa, to come around, they've got to feel like we are merciful, to use your good word, and that we are forgiving.
And you're part of the union.
And that we want them to succeed in their lives and their businesses and their families. Mm-hmm. And Lincoln's whole perspective was, we're going to make that happen. We're going to view them in a way that'll be constructive and that they'll want to play ball and reunite.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with the new Oval Office and Talmadge Boston is at YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts. Check it out and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Visit RaymondArroyo.com for all the links. You know him as the director of the wildly successful streaming hit The Chosen. I recently joined him on the set of the show to discuss the release of season 5 of The Chosen, Last Supper Part 1. It hits theaters Friday, March 28th. Here's my exclusive interview with Dallas Jenkins. I want to start with Left Behind, and you apparently haven't been left behind. Your dad is Jerry,
yes,
who best known for the Left Behind series. What did he teach you, Dallas, about not only storytelling and an approach to storytelling, but maintaining a franchise, which is the hard part?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I got a front row seat to a lot of things with Left Behind that parallel what happened with The Chosen. And because I was there, I was able to learn a lot. Now, yes, being raised by a storyteller helps, of course. But I also saw how the Left Behind series started very small, started to grow, word of mouth started to grow, and then all of a sudden it exploded and it became the thing, right? And I watched him not get more self-involved or arrogant or proud or self-reliant. It was the opposite. He got more humble. He got more surrendered, more desperate for help. And that was the biggest thing. And as we've seen this happen with The Chosen, where The Chosen started from nothing and then started to grow and then all of a sudden exploded, I was able to lean on him a little bit and go, I feel unworthy of this. What is going on here? And he said, welcome to the club. You know, and I'm like, this reminds me of when you were on your knees this whole time during Left Behind, just asking for help to manage it. And yes, to your question, to maintain the franchise. And that's, I think, the only way is to lose the ego the whole time. Mm. If I can maintain this surrendered posture that I found right before The Chosen, when I had a big career failure, and I was like, yeah, I just want to be in your will. I don't care about the results. Well, if suddenly when the results start coming in and you start caring, yeah, you're back to square one, and I, God have mercy on my soul if I go back there. So I want to follow in his footsteps.
Well, that surrender is a real strong theme, not only with yourself, with Jonathan Rumi well. Yeah. This idea, you know, you were kind of up against the wall. You had this movie that didn't do what you wanted it to do, fantastic movie, you were with a big Hollywood studio. You said at that time you did not want to be known as a Christian filmmaker. And yet, following that, you're making these small films for your church.
Yes.
How does that add up?
Well, some of it's about semantics and public marketing and whatnot. When you hear the term Christian film, Christian filmmaker, at that time, I was almost embarrassed by it because it brought with it a connotation.
Well, it brings a bias among some people who don't understand fully what it is.
Yeah, and they don't want to watch anything that's quote-unquote Christian or faith-based. It implies that it's only for a certain group of people, and it also carries with it the weight of a lack of quality in a lot of people's minds. I mean, the faith-based, I've been part of it for many years, and faith-based film world and TV world has always been a little bit behind, so I kind of wanted to distance myself from that. But yet, I still had a very strong passion for Christ-centered projects. I just didn't want them to have this label slapped on them that said, this is not for you. Yeah. I surrendered all that. You know, at the time, like you mentioned, I started doing these short films for my church, stories of Christ, but from different perspectives. This whole concept of not changing the story, but maybe telling it from someone else's viewpoint was an interesting way to kind of recharge the battery for those of us who've heard these stories so many times. Well,
there was something you said at one point. You said you equated your journey to the feeding of the 5,000.
Yeah.
How did that eternal math work itself out in your head?
Well, it didn't work itself out in my head. It was from somebody else. I was at home alone, literally drying my tears and my wife's tears as we were experiencing this career failure. And out of the blue, while we're trying to wrestle with this and wondering, am I supposed to be in this industry? And genuinely saying, maybe I'm not meant for this. Yeah. Maybe I shouldn't be doing this. I mean, this was not that long ago. This is in 2017. And God just put it on my wife's heart, Amanda, as clearly as if it was an audible voice. Read the story of the feeding of the 5,000. So, I'm like, okay, we've heard this 100 times. Let's see what we can glean from it. What does God have for us? Mm-hmm. So we open it up and we're reading the story. And we're noticing a few things we hadn't noticed before, such as the fact that Jesus wasn't surprised by their hunger. He's the one who had actually been talking for 3 days. It was actually his fault they were so hungry. He brought them to the desperation point that they were at so that he could satisfy the miracle that they needed. So that was notable, but we couldn't quite glean what he had for us from it, and the numbers weren't growing like they did with the feeding of the 5,000. So we're thinking, maybe it's
that's not for us.
That night at 4 o'clock in the morning, while I am busy doing a post-mortem trying to understand everything and writing out a big memo, I get a message from someone across the world, literally in Romania, who just felt led by God out of the blue to just didn't say hi, didn't say hello, didn't say heard about your movie, just said, remember, your job is not to feed the 5,000, it's only to provide the loaves and fish. And I looked around, I'm thinking, did my computer record what I was talking about with my wife today?
That AI's getting real good.
Yes, I'm thinking, how did this person know what we've been wrestling with all day long? And I've met him since then. He was a guy I barely knew, just a Facebook friend. And he just said, God just put it as clearly on his heart as he had on my wife's heart. Tell Dallas, it's not his job to feed the 5,000, it's only provide the loaves and fish. So that has become my whole surrendered posture since that moment, is I'm focused on making the best loaves and fish that I can. We're sitting on this set right now. Mm-hmm. I'm filming right now, while I will be in a few minutes. Yeah. That's my loaves and fish. I'm not thinking about whether there's one person watching or 100 million people watching. I'm not thinking about whether I'm going to see a YouTube video that calls me a heretic or a YouTube video that calls me the greatest filmmaker who's ever lived. None of those things can impact the work. None of those things can matter when I'm making the loaves and fish. It's up to God to do the multiplication. I'm just here to watch it happen.
Feed them. Organize the people into groups of 50 and 100. Gather up 12 baskets to distribute the loaves and fish.
Where did this idea come from? The way, because you said it a moment ago, we've all heard these stories hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of times.
Yes.
Your perspective on it was that you would see Christ through the eyes of those he affected. And when I heard that the first time, I thought of Orson Welles. You know, Welles wanted to do a movie from the POV of Jesus, where you never see Jesus' face, just how he encounters everybody else.
Yes.
Is that kind of the conceit here of The Chosen?
Well, even with Orson Welles' idea, the idea was that Jesus is the perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that, I've seen it done many times, and it's fine, and I love seeing the Bible portrayed, but Jesus makes actually for not a great literary character. He's not a great protagonist. He doesn't learn anything.
No.
He doesn't change. He doesn't become better from being bad.
The character arc is kind of...
It's not boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets a girl back. Like you said, the character arc is here. And so I thought, if we were able to experience Jesus through those who were around him, including his enemies, and maybe if we saw Jesus through the eyes of those who actually met him when he was here in person, maybe we could be changed and impacted in the same way they were. And so you might identify with Mary Magdalene, you might identify with Nicodemus, you might identify with Peter, or in my case, you identify a little bit with all of them. But then seeing how they were impacted by Jesus and knowing their stories before they met him has really seemed to be the secret sauce.
This is part of a longer conversation, right? There's more clarity coming.
Let's give him some time, Andrew.
I love you.
I don't identify with Mary Magdalene. I just want to go on the record and say that, okay? Maybe Nicodemus or one of the others, but not Mary Magdalene,
all right, good to know.
No demons cast out. Tell me about the process. I see you running around here. I know you were rehearsing, you're prepping scenes. You've got multiple stages here that you're working in, sound stages and standalone streets.
Whoa.
How does the process work of actually writing the episodes? I know you write with two other collaborators.
I mean, and we're writing right now. I mean, as we're filming season five, in between setups, I'll sometimes go to my trailer and work on editing notes for season five, notes on season six writing. Tyler, Ryan, and I are the three writers who write every word of the show, and we get together before each season. We plot out the major points, and we plot out the eight episodes, and then they write the first drafts, and then get them to me, and then I put my stamp on it, and that's the final draft of it. But that process doesn't stop. The train has left the station and isn't going to slow down anytime soon.
Tell me about this crowdfunding model, which is pretty extraordinary that you coined, but now you've gone to a nonprofit model. How is that working out? And B, do you have the money for the season you're currently shooting?
Yeah, all right, all good questions. So the nonprofit model that we're in now came about because the free model that we had, where watch it for free, choose to pay for it or not, and that worked great, but we're a for-profit company in that we have investors, we have to have long-term sustainability. But that model, our goal is to get the show to as many people as possible, but when less than 3% of the viewers are actually paying for it, it's tough to sustain.
Right.
And the show's getting bigger. And, you know, you've got Actors Union and Writers Union struck, and the crew union struck. You have to pay more. So the nonprofit model became the only way for us to have long-term sustainability. So it's working great. We're about to complete our financing for this season. The nonprofit Come and See has ensured, they've said, look, we're going to make sure you get to keep on schedule while they raise money.
Wow.
We don't have a big studio or network behind us saying, here's your, you know, we see this is going to work. We're going to write a big, you know, $500 million check to make sure you're good. We got to keep,
It's a walk of faith, though. You know,
I
worked for a woman, Mother Angelica, who founded a network, and this is how she operated.
Yeah.
She said, Providence only moves when you move. If you don't move, he won't move.
Yeah.
My
wife calls it the manna program, which is every morning we come out with our hands outstretched for our daily manna.
Mm-hmm.
And God told the Israelites, don't store it up. If you store it up and start saving it for a future, I will make it rot. He wanted them reliant on him, and I think he wants us reliant on him for this.
And that
as well.
Posture of, help me, I need help.
Surrender.
You've heard the critiques, and I've heard them too. There are people who love the story. Some say it's too colloquial.
Yeah.
Why is it so casual?
Yeah.
Did they really talk that way? Come on, Dallas.
Yeah.
You would say what?
I would say they were human beings like we were. Jesus, of course, is fully human, fully divine, I believe, in the hypostatic union. But it's very clear he was a Jewish boy born and raised in Israel. And there's no reason to assume that 2,000 years ago they acted like stained glass windows or statues. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we project onto them a formality that comes from a good place. Yeah. Reverence. We want to honor them. We want to respect them. We want to walk in their shoes, follow their steps. But I think the beauty of the story is that we're following the steps of people who were flawed human beings, fallen, just like we were, needed a savior just like we do, had questions, doubts, and struggles just like we do. When you take that away and turn it into this formal, kind of distant thing, I think it actually not only hurts us and takes away from the power and causes some people, members of the church or people who've considered Christianity and then rejected it because they're saying, I can't relate to this. I can't live up to these saints. And you're like, no, they were like you. They just recognized their need for a savior.
I've read a lot of commentary, critiques of the Chosen. Mm-hmm. People saying it works for this reason, it works for that reason. I want to know from you, why do you think it's resonating now more powerfully and frankly in a far larger way than when you started this project, when you first conceived it?
The timing of this has turned out to be somewhat transcendent. I mean, our culture globally and here in the States is more tribal than ever. We have drawn very, very strong lines politically, even gender, even spiritually. And of course, ethnically and nationally, we've drawn just these really strong lines. And the moment you step outside of that line, you must be playing for the other team and you're not one of us anymore. You say the wrong thing, you're done, right? This is exactly the time period that Jesus came into. He entered a time where there were national, spiritual, religious, gender, racial lines drawn. And when Jesus came, they thought, he's going to be here to fight the war, to win. We're going to dominate. We're going to finally beat our oppressors. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what a lot of people today are wrongly looking for. And what they actually need and what they're looking for without knowing it, perhaps, is that Jesus' message of there is one Savior, and it's him. And he's not here to actually win a war. He's actually here to start a new kingdom in your heart.
May the light of the Paschal feast burn within you, that with heavenly desires and pure minds, you may attain the festival of everlasting light, the kingdom I am bringing into this world.
I think there's something about that that's resonating with people and told in this human way. I hear from people everywhere I go. It's so human, it's so authentic, and that makes them then open to believing it's true. Because it doesn't feel fake, it doesn't feel presented, it doesn't feel performed. It feels authentic and real and human, and that makes people think, man, that actually could have happened, and maybe I can experience the same change and the same surrender that they did.
Dallas, thank you for the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Season 5 of The Chosen, Last Supper, directed by Dallas Jenkins, hits theaters Friday, March 28th, with Part 1 and then Part 2 on April 4th. For showtimes and tickets in your area, you can check your local listings and visit thechosenlastsupper.com. And I can hardly believe it has been 9 years today that Reverend Mother Mary Angelica died on March 27th, 2016. Wow. She left us on the eve of Easter, and Mother was that rare combination of a contemplative nun who was at the same time a suffering servant and a trailblazing broadcaster. You know what I miss most, and what I've tried to preserve, I guess, in my own work? Her joy, her sense of fun, her spunk. Mother once told me, if you're not a thorn in somebody's side, you're not doing Christianity right. Well, I followed her pattern. There's such movement to go with the flow today, I think, and to get along and to make no waves. But Mother was just the opposite. She inspired us with fire to run toward the eternal, toward the Lord, against the current, no matter the cost. And her watchword to me when we started this news endeavor almost 30 years ago was, tell the truth no matter where it leads. And I've tried to stay true to that charge. And lest you think Mother's journey was smooth or easy, read the sequel of my biography, Mother Angelica, Her Grand Silence, where it chronicles the last years of her life when she really was unable to speak, confined to the corner room of her monastery, communing only with her spouse. It was a hard road. But look at the fruits of that suffering. Look at the fruits of that journey. What an incredible legacy and example Mother Angelica's left us. People forget how she wasn't exactly embraced warmly by the powerful or even church authorities. They weren't inviting her to the galas, I can promise you. In fact, that they didn't like her all that much. It's called jealousy. But she once said, and I love this, and I'm quoting, "I'm not here to win friends and influence people. I'm here to do the will of God." Well, may we be filled with that spirit and do it with the same joy and lasting impact of dear Reverend Mother. Pray for those you left behind, Mama, who attempt to carry on your mission, and rest in peace, my dear. The Trump administration is set to freeze funding to family planning groups, including Planned Parenthood, and a bill has been introduced in the Senate that would prohibit federal funding of research using tissue obtained through abortions. Here with analysis of these developments and much more is neuroscientist and senior ethicist at the National Catholic Bioethics Center, Father Tad Pacholczyk. Father, thank you for being here. The U.S. Senate voted Tuesday evening to confirm President Trump's pick to lead the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya. He's been on the show before. He was a leading voice during COVID-19 against lockdown measures and vaccine mandates. In his confirmation hearing, Dr. Bhattacharya said that he would not allow the use of aborted fetal tissue in research. Watch.
Will you prohibit the use of aborted fetal tissue in NIH research, NIH-funded research?
Senator, I'll absolutely follow the lead of Secretary Kennedy and President Trump on this. In public health, we need to make sure the products of the science are ethically acceptable to everybody. And so having alternatives that are not ethically conflicted to a fetal stem cell lines is not just an ethical issue, but it's a public health issue.
Father, are you encouraged by the confirmation of Dr. Bhattacharya? And what kind of ethics reviews do you think he'll set into motion as head of the NIH?
Yes, I'm very encouraged, Raymond. I think that there's a high likelihood that he's going to set into motion good ethical review. You know, I think back to the former Trump administration, and they set up a commission that, you know, served and did great work on this, the Human Fetal Tissue Ethics Research Advisory Board.
And you were on that board, by the way.
Absolutely, yes. And it was a remarkable group, Raymond. I mean, there were 15 of us as members, and I've never seen, you know, such seriousness about ethics in research. It was a delight to be a member. And we reviewed grant proposals to the NIH. And if those grant proposals were suggesting that you should be able to use tissues from abortions or cells derived from abortions, then those proposals came before us. And we either did, you know, thumbs up or thumbs down. And it was incredible to see the effect of this. And of course, there was a lot of pushback from many in the science community who said, you know, we're good at providing our own ethics. You should allow us to auto-regulate, that sort of thing. And they were very upset. But it was effective. And I think that it's likely there will be a board of that kind again, or some other mechanism via which there is sureness that our tax dollars are not going in the direction of supporting morally objectionable research. Most Americans, you know, I think he was right in his testimony when he said, Americans want to be comfortable about using the kinds of medicines, vaccines, and other developments that come from science and not have kind of a torn conscience over this and a divided conscience in some way.
Father, people sometimes say that if we allow the use of tissues from abortions to develop treatment and cures, that helps redeem the unfortunate occurrence of abortion. Why does it not redeem abortion to use those tissues? And what do you say to members of the scientific community who say, look, I've got a permission slip from the woman who had the abortion, and she said this is fine with her?
Yeah, you know, that's a very common ploy that is used
Yeah,
by
it is.
scientists. Yeah, absolutely. And they say, you know, it's all ethically good here. We got the signature on the dotted line. Don't worry, we're fine. But the problem is, whenever you do a request for informed consent from somebody on behalf of someone else, and that's what's happening here, it's the mother on behalf of the baby. Well, the assumption is that you have the best interests of that person that you're giving consent for. So, like if you or I were doing that for our mother, as she's dying, she becomes unconscious. I give consent for a particular surgery. I have my mom's best interest in mind. But in the case of the abortion, the woman has categorically demonstrated by choosing the abortion, she does not have the best interests of this child in mind. And therefore, she has disqualified herself from being able to give informed consent. So, very, very important point here. We shouldn't be playing along with these kinds of fictions that the scientists sometimes put forward that are just sort of workarounds to avoid the real ethics that are involved. And then the question you raised about, you know,
Redeeming.
redeeming the abortion. A lot of people think that, oh, if we can use some of the cells derived from the abortion, it will redeem the act, a terrible act. But in fact, what it does is it exacerbates the situation. Why? Because we are failing in that instance to respect the remains of the dead. And that's our duty at that point. We shouldn't allow scientists to come in and chop up the bodies of these young and vulnerable human beings who have died and put them up for sale. I mean, you may recall the whole controversy with the University of Pittsburgh where they were doing this, and there was payment that was being made for different body parts, livers, thymuses, heads of the babies, that $550 per head it was. You know, so just a remarkable loss of a sense of the moral compass that had happened there. And this suggestion that somehow we're able to redeem an abortion, again, is another one of these fictions that gets out there to justify what is, at the end of the day, Raymond, unjustifiable.
The Trump administration is expected to freeze about $20 million in funding to Planned Parenthood, Father, among other organizations that receive family planning grants. Now, they're really reviewing whether the recipient is in compliance with President Trump's directive that all these federal contractors remove diversity, equity, and inclusion programs or initiatives from their facilities or programs. Planned Parenthood is responsible for around 400,000 abortions annually. How important is this executive review?
I would say this is extremely important. You know, you mentioned that the review is being done under the auspices of looking at DEI compliance. And I mean, it's worth noting, many Americans don't know this fact, but Planned Parenthood has very quickly moved into LGBTQ activism, and they are one of the groups that make available hormones to young people so they can start gender transitioning. And you know, this is, you say to yourself, well, gee, I thought they were involved with dealing with women's health. So they've gone, you know, in very, very diverse directions. And this, I think there's going to be a lot of concern in terms of the DEI compliance. But you know, to go further here, I think it's important to understand that Planned Parenthood has, in a certain sense, been getting taxpayer subsidies for a very long time. They receive close to $500 million altogether. And this is a type of funding which theoretically everybody says, oh, you know, they're not allowed to use it for abortions because of the Hyde Amendment. Well, we all know what happens. The money goes in, it's putatively for contraception or for some other aspect of women's health, but it just gets rooted into the support of the entire structure of Planned Parenthood. The money is diverted into, you know, other forms of support. So it turns out that Planned Parenthood is not only the largest abortion provider in America, but it's also the largest recipient of Title X, Title X dollars. And these are grants that are supposed to be funding critical women's health services for low-income Americans. But what the thing is, this money is given out to Planned Parenthood upfront. It's an upfront donation, which is different, for example, than Medicaid, where you get money after the fact. So this is a direct support of the many wrongs that Planned Parenthood is supporting. And taxpayers are right to be up in arms on this and to be saying, we don't want our funds to be going to supporting a group like Planned Parenthood, especially to the tune of $500 million.
Yeah. Father, look, this is all very consistent with, well, you saw it up close. This is very consistent with the Trump administration's record during the first go-round on life. I mean, it sort of made me laugh this week when I see some of these so-called pro-life leaders who militantly oppose the election of the current president fuming about how Trump was not pro-life during the campaign and would endanger the cause, who now are injuring their fingers writing, oh, big win for the president, this is great, as if they were on the campaign. I haven't seen people change costumes that quickly since I was backstage in the theater, Father. But I guess the fundraising has to continue, and the amnesia is a reoccurring condition for some. I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's important that we acknowledge the kinds of positive changes that are occurring in the administration, I believe. I know some people are critical from, you know, vantage points of immigration or other angles, but it's very clear that there are many steps that have been taken that are very pro-life by this administration. You know, because we did a show not that long ago on IVF and the Trump position on IVF. That's clearly a problem as well. So it's not perfect, but we've got to be honest people who look at the good and affirm the good when we find it. And where there's problems, we point them out and work to improve the situation in our government. You know, the U.S. example, just to close on this, Raymond, I think the example that the United States provides to the rest of the world, just there's no substitute for it. Whether you're talking about funding of fetal research, whether you're talking about funding of abortion entities like Planned Parenthood, everybody watches what we're doing. And so our example becomes really critical in policies being made not just at home, but overseas.
Yeah. Father Tad Boholcik, I thank you for always calling balls and strikes in this area, which we always try to do here. And I know not everybody's happy with us when it's over, but we call them as we seize them. Father Tad Boholcik's commentary at the National Catholic Bioethics Center can be found at their website, ncbcenter.org. Thank you, Father.
Thank you so much, Raymond.
A bit of sad news for many of us here at EWTN News. Our beloved colleague of 5 years, Tracy Sable, has stepped down as host of EWTN's News Nightly. Tracy is a dear friend and a bright ray of sunshine to all of us here, and she will certainly be missed. She knew and loved and respected EWTN's audience, mother's audience, and you know that she brought you the news cleanly and clearly every evening. So her presence will be missed, and her spirit, and we wish her well on her next adventure, and, you know, we're very sad to see her go. That is all the time we have for now, but be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we will be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thanks for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.